This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, along with the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld. We are in our Lexington, Kentucky studios and extending a very special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206, and everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your smartphone, or your tablet at horseracingradio.net. You know, over the past several years, we've had the privilege, and I do call it a privilege, to visit with many of the most prolific trainers in the sport of thoroughbred racing. Bill Mott, Todd Pletcher, Bob Baffert, Kieran McLaughlin, Nick Zito, Richard Mandela, just to name a few. They've all been here on Trainer Talk. And JT, tonight we kind of take a little different angle with the program, as tonight's guest doesn't even officially have his trainer's license yet. How about that?
That's kind of interesting to have a trainer on, but I was reading the story and it's a unique perspective on how to train horses and prepare them mentally and physically for all the rigors of racing.
Yeah, I think there's little doubt that our guest this evening, even though he does not have that name on the trainer side of things, he is definitely a household name. You're going to know him. He's 37 years old. He was born in Easton, New Hampshire, which, in case you're wondering, is only about 31 square miles with a population of right around 250. He's best known as an Olympic and World Championship gold medalist and the most successful male alpine skier of all time. He has earned multiple medals at the highest level of competition, including 4 gold medals in the World Championships and an Olympic gold, which came in Vancouver in 2010. And if you don't know by now, I'm talking about Bodie Miller, and he is with us on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Bodie, welcome to the program, my friend.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to have you here. Let's start with the obvious question. I run through all of those accolades and those achievements that you've accomplished as an athlete. Why on earth would anyone want to get into training horses after all that?
Well, I think, you know, as a lot of us face at the end of our careers, you know, there's a certain amount of enjoyment that everyone gets out of a career, especially like ski racing, where, you know, most people, I would say, don't get into ski racing to make a bunch of money. It's just not one of those sports that does that. It's not a mainstream American sport where you get the million-dollar contract. And, you know, it's an amateur sport. It's based around the Olympics. You know, we do it for that reason alone. And I think, you know, for me, having that excitement fill the whole first, really half, you know, hopefully a third of my life, you know, I wanted to fill that gap as, you know, as I got out of ski racing. And you know, the only thing that I would say steered me directly, besides my love for the sport of horse racing, is just the set of skills that I developed as a ski racer just really tend to correspond overly with horse racing compared to what you would think. There's just ski racing is such a strange sport, the way that you grow up through it. And, you know, in horse racing, you need a specific set of skills to be effective at it. And like you said, I don't have my trainer's license, but when I go and look at the demands and talk to my friends who are trainers, you know, and Bob and those guys, the challenges that they face are the same, you know, are addressed by the same skill set that I've, you know, developed over the last 25 years. So it really is kind of a natural fit in terms of the acquired skill set and the fact that I love the sport and that it's so thrilling and exciting when you see a horse that you've invested your time and energy into and really taken care of. When you see a horse win, you know, it's an amazing thrill. It, you know, I would say it's very comparable to winning World Cup.
I can see the correlation with ski racing. It's ski racing's a lifestyle, just like the thoroughbred training business is a lifestyle. It's a devotion to the sport. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So I can see if you have that drive to go out and practice every day and to be the best at your game, how you could easily excel at racing, which requires the same type of devotion.
Yeah, and it's, you know, even more so. I mean, I think a lot of things in life would qualify into that sort of a, you know, into that sort of a class. But the thing that's interesting about horse racing that, you know, you need to have a team for one thing. I mean, you know, you can't. It's one of those sports you obviously can't do it by yourself. No matter how many hours you're willing to spend doing it, you have to be. You have to be fair and good at managing people, and you know, you have to be good at motivating people and good at finding, you know, inspiration and things like that, which are all, which are all important parts of, you know, ski racing as well. But the things that I was talking about are so specific, you know, in terms of looking at a condition book. You know, if you took somebody off the street and said, you know, here, look at this condition book and tell me what you think and tell me, you know, here's this horse. And, you know, you can watch it train a little bit and you can look at its training times. And I want you to pick some races that it goes in. Most people would really struggle at finding the correct race to place that horse in. And because of my, you know, ski racing is actually, not that you guys would know, because ski racing is such an obscure sport at that level. But as a young kid, you know, when you're 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, you learn this really weird skill set of comparing races. One race in Colorado, one race in Vermont, one race in Maine, and then one race in Switzerland, say. And based on all these factors and these calculations and numbers, you have to assess the quality of the racer, who won, how fast they were that day comparatively to a racer who raced in Colorado on the same day or 2 days later. And that, you know, when you first start off is, I mean, no parent really even knows how to do it. I mean, this, you know, 10 and 11-year-old kids learn how to do it, just like little kids learn how to use iPads because they're motivated to do it. You know, this is the sport we all loved. And when we learn that skill set, you know, I could literally look at a race in New Hampshire and say, okay, the race was covered 1,000 vertical feet. It was a minute 13 seconds long. Here was the best guys in the race. Here's how far back I finished from those best guys. And, you know, the variation there. And then I would look at the same things, calculate the slope and the penalty and be able to say, okay, I'm competitive with this kid who just got 15th place in a race over in Switzerland, and I'm also competitive with this kid who got third place out in Colorado. So, you know, if those guys were in a race that was in Vermont, I would say, okay, I can go in that race and I'll be competitive with those two guys. And that, you know, ironically, that is the exact skill set that's probably, I would say, the most underutilized in the horse racing business, is that, you know, making sure that you know what your horses are capable of and you put them into the races that they're most suited for.
Visiting with Olympic gold medalist Bodie Miller here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bodie, where did that love of horse racing begin for you?
You know, my grandfather used to go. There was a track in New Hampshire. You'll have to look it up. I think it was in like Camden, maybe. You know, this is 60 years ago, probably. And he used to go down the track and bet. So I think it was a love of his. But he used to bet like, you know, 30 cents or whatever. And then, you know, in the spring we had a tennis camp, and we resurfaced our own clay tennis courts. And I just remember every May, you know, I'd be out doing courts, because that's the time of the year where you're fixing up your tennis courts, getting ready for the summer. And my grandmother would put on her dress and put on her pearls and have a, you know, a mint julep, and she'd call us all in, and we'd watch the Kentucky Derby. And, you know, it was just one of those things that at the time I didn't really recognize what it was, but it was a tradition in my family that I was exposed to from a really young age. So I think as I got older and, you know, I happened to, you know, fall into some really interesting, you know, opportunities. One was with a relationship with Visa, when Visa had the Visa Triple Crown around 2000, somewhere around there, where they brought me into the Kentucky Derby as one of their, you know, sort of representatives. And I got to, you know, I walked through the museum and I spent time there and, you know, that I've been to the Derby every year since then. except for this last year when my child was being born mostly. So, you know, it's one of those things, I guess it kind of just, the pieces fell in place. Although, you know, the sport, like I said, it's an objective sport like ski racing is. There's not, I mean, while the stewards can poke their nose in there here and there, it's generally just based on time. It doesn't matter if the horse looks funny winning, as long as they have a faster, as long as they're faster, no one can say anything. And that was really one of my greatest loves of ski racing, was everyone always said that my style looked like crap, but I was fast. And I think I relate that to horse racing as well.
That happens a lot with jockeys too. They used to say Sandy Hawley wasn't very pretty on a horse, yet he won tons of races and is in the Hall of Fame. So it's not a beauty contest, but we've all seen horses that you go, how did that horse win that race? But what's the key to getting faster when you're ski racing? You know now who your competition is, but how do you get faster?
You know, as you guys have you know, probably seen for a long time now, you know, there's a constant battle between, you know, between science and what you'd call instinct or horsemanship. And that goes in every sport. I mean, there's the good old boy mentality, and there's, you know, everyone's, you know, we have these restrictions on equipment, and we have all these different entities that in sports and, you know, that kind of, that vie for control and make different things difficult. But, you know, the reality is you need to evolve. Things need to progress forward. If they don't progress forward, then generally they're progressing backwards because, you know, as you've seen in horse racing, we don't train horses the same as we did 40 years ago. We train them significantly worse, I would say. And that could be argued either way, I suppose, except that the horses get hurt a lot and the times aren't really, you know, we're not breaking records, at least not in the endurance stuff. The sprinters, you know, maybe we've increased, you know, some of the sprinting speeds, but that could also be attributed to the surfaces they're running on. But, you know, when I read a really cool article about War Admiral, you know, just a random one, and he raced, I don't know what he raced, I think he raced four times or five times in the first month of his career as a two-year-old. And won, I think, all five or was second and won. It's just one of those kind of articles that just it gets your brain thinking a little bit about what animals are capable of and what's their natural environment and how do we improve them? How do we get them to race better? And, you know, some of the conversations that I have with trainers are frustrating, but more so just in a superficial kind of way, and that Bob doesn't really believe that you can improve a horse. You know, he thinks they're born what they are, and they, you know, they race, and that's how it is. And it's tough for me because that's proven to be factually incorrect, and it's been proven a thousand times. And, you know, there's really obvious ways that you can improve a horse. The way to do it in the safest way has only become really possible, and, you know, it's changed a lot, and I'm sure it'll continue to change, has only become possible in the last probably 10 years where our ability to monitor the animals has increased so much with you know, some of the algorithms for heart rate variability and some of the ways that you can train a horse on a high-speed treadmill in a lab-type environment so you can get some parameters to work with on the track. Because if you're doing everything on the track, you can naturally see the difficulty in that, you know, people don't want to hurt the horse, so they err on the side of safety. And the more you err on the side of safety but still have to race at race speeds, then anytime you have a huge variance between what you're training and what you're actually doing in competition, you're asking for injuries. And that's across the board in any sport. And, you know, right now in horse racing, I don't think we've ever had a larger gap between what the average trainer is doing with his horses in training and what he's asking his horse to do in the racing for him. And I think that, you know, that's what I intend to change the most drastically.
Yeah, I think when you read an article about Bodie Miller getting involved with horse racing on the training side of things, you always come back to modern training techniques. That's kind of the three words that are often used to describe your philosophy, Bodie. And you mentioned closing that gap. How do you close that gap? And how do you bring a more modern approach to training horses? How do you do it?
Well, I mean, the technology, application of modern technology is the biggest one. And then making sure that you really pay attention to the historical evidence and the significance of the experience of the past. You know, and it's really not it's not hard. It's just hard to maintain the discipline and to be detail-oriented enough that you don't let things slip through the crack. And the fact is you have to have a really good system of monitoring and recording information so you can not have a lot of, you know, false positives and false negatives. You know, the reality is that is the biggest issue is, you know, someone will have a horse and they'll say, you know, they'll do a training work and they'll say, oh, he had some feeling in his legs and he got sore after this work. That was too much for him. And the reality is that might have been, had nothing to do with it. It might have been something totally different. And so that person then thinks that that was too much for, that was too much for that horse. And they've got a false negative on that, you know, on that training work. Whereas the having the right application of modern technology where you can monitor a horse and you can really tell, you know, where the injury comes from, if the training load is enough for their system, you know, that I think is the biggest step. And that then you can start to, you know, what the idea with any training program is to gently probe the limits of what your athlete is capable of. But, and by gently, I mean gently. You have to gently probe the limits and not blast through the limits or shove against the limits too hard, or you will have injuries. But you can't stay far away from those limits either. Otherwise, you're missing an opportunity to improve the athlete. And I think right now, everyone, because of the fear of hurting the animals and you know, the difficulties of that, you know, everyone's erring far away from that. So, you know, they're generally not getting a very good conditioning program into most of the athletes.
When I was doing some research about this program, I read something on the internet, which I never believe until I check with the source, but it said something to the effect that you talked about horses not being trained at the distances that they're going to run. And I thought that was very unique because nowadays a lot of trainers never work over a half a mile, maybe once in a while 5/8. But in the old days, some of the guys that I came up under, Charlie Whittingham, for example, used to work horses miles in 136 and change or 137. And now I see that Baffert's starting to incorporate some of that into his training program, and hence horses like American Pharoah coming around and running, you know, huge. Was that a true statement in the article that I read? Is that part of what you're trying to do?
Well, I think, like I said, narrowing the gap between what a horse or an athlete is asked to do in competition, narrowing the gap to what they're asked to do or what their routine is for training. I think you got to narrow that gap. The reality is that the best success and the ability to maximize an athlete comes when the race day is actually slightly easier than training days. And how it's easier is a matter of perspective. But the reality is, a training day for a horse right now is, you know, a short warm up, you know, like you said, a half a mile or a 5-furlong breeze at roughly 20% slower than race speed. You know, they might breeze 48. You know, somebody fast might breeze 47. You know, the same horse, you know, could potentially be capable of running 44 for a half mile. Or 56 or 55, you know, I mean, who knows? So, you know, you're talking about a pretty significant, you know, that's 5%, 6% off of race speed, even at a fast breeze. You know, the reality is that there should be, a horse should be going at 10-second furlongs. If you're doing speed works, you know, they should be doing 10-second furlongs or, you know, 10 to whatever they're capable of, and just a furlong. And then recover, and then do a furlong, and then recover, and then do a furlong. And if you do that, I mean, you know, people have got scared away from the interval training theory a long time ago because it hurt horses, because you couldn't monitor, and because the people administering those programs had no experience with it and didn't really know what they were doing. And, of course, that's all true. We've come across the same thing in humans. If you don't know what you're doing, interval training can be really dangerous. But if you do know what you're doing, it's also by far the most beneficial to the system, because you can address a lot of these things and move forward really pretty quickly and pretty safely. So, you know, if you're doing long works, then your work should be, you know, 15, 20, 30% longer than the race. And it can be a little bit slower, and you can do different things to minimize the chance of injury. But ideally, you'd come into a race having a really clear picture of what your goal was. You know, here's what my horse is capable of. Here's the target for today. Here's what we want them to run. here's what he ran these last four works that we did that are very, very comparable in terms of workload and speed to what he's going to have to do today. And at that case, you could pick a race where you more or less knew what he was, you know, going to do. I mean, of course, there's always the variables. It is still horse racing, but you do a much better job. As opposed to most of the trainers out there, like you said, run half mile or 5/8. They're running, you know, 10-20% slower than race speed. Then they go and throw their horse into a 6.5 furlong or 7 furlong race. So you're asking them to go 20% longer, and you're asking them to go 10% faster. And that's just a recipe for disaster. If you talk to anyone in sports science or physiology, they'll tell you that that's not a good system if you want to keep a horse healthy.
Visiting with Bodie Miller on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. As you can tell, he has a unique philosophy and approach to training horses. He is just getting into that side of the business. And Bodie, you mentioned a couple of times now the name of Hall of Famer Bob Baffert, and it's been well documented that you have a very close relationship with Bob and his wife Jill. They named their son Bodie after you. Tell me about that relationship and how that came about.
It was really interesting. So Bob had watched me in the 2002 Olympics, and I'd already been to the Derby, I think once or twice at that point. But he had a horse in the race that year, but it wasn't a great horse the first year that I met him there. And I got Tim Layden, who was a writer for Sports Illustrated at the time, who I knew from you know, he'd written some articles on me. He was there down in the paddock, and I was in the paddock, and he said, "Hey, you know, Bob Baffert, you know, it wasn't 2002, but Bob had watched me in 2002. It was just after Bodie had been born, and he, you know, Tim said, "Hey, would you like to meet Bob?" He named his son after you. And I said, "Sure." I'd known of Bob since, you know, 97, 98, when he had those great runs that almost make him the Triple Crown. And so we went over and I met him, and he, you know, Bob's just such a nice guy. He's so, you know, he's gregarious. He's really got a great personality. He's such a good showman. And I recognize, you know, a lot of the same sort of personality traits that I like in all my friends in him right away. And, you know, so we basically hit it off. He's such an easy guy to get along with. And then, you know, it was years really after that we bought our first horse together. And he trained him, and you know, it was during that time I was always kind of poking at him and asking him questions, because I already knew that I wanted to go into the business, but I was curious as to, you know, what his impression of how come he was successful and all that stuff. And it, as I got deeper into it, you know, which is not totally uncommon with me, is I was surprised at how strange his system was, and how I could appreciate it, because I was accused of the same thing in my sport. But he really had an unusual way of going about it, and it completely ignored a lot of really obvious advantages, in my opinion. So, you know, we had a lot of long, funny conversations where he would call me crazy and I'd call him crazy, and all good-natured. But, you know, in the end, we sort of more or less said, okay, we're not going to talk about training anymore, because we're too far apart. He just, you know, thinks that all the science side of it is complete voodoo and crazy talk, and for me not to use any of that stuff at all, or use any time trialing, or use any heart rate monitors, or any GPS, or anything like that to track anything, seems like you're just, you know, it's a little bit too much. He won't weigh the horses. He says he can tell with his eye how heavy they are, and he thinks it's like a weakness or something crazy if you have to use a scale to tell how heavy a horse is. But you know, we've proven over and over again that the eye is very fallible in that regard. And having daily weights of horses is a great way to track calorie intake and you know, water retention and a bunch of other things. So, you know, anyway, it was a great relationship, and it was amazing. I think Bob is you know, obviously there's no disputing his prowess in the horse racing business, and I love picking his brain, and I still do it a lot, but we end up, usually ends up telling me to stop asking questions and get too mad.
Well, you may have a bigger influence on him than you think. Now, he's always been one guy that worked his horses faster than everybody else, which is part of your system, but now he's started to work horses longer, and that's the other half of your system. So maybe you're exerting a little bit more influence, even though he's not doing it technically. He's still doing it mindfully.
Yeah, and you know, and I have talked to him a ton. I don't know that I can really claim to have much influence on him, but I mean, I've been in his ear a lot about it. And the reality is, the one piece that I think he is missing is the frequency of training. And I do believe the horses get some small, cumulative conditioning effect from a gallop, which they do every day, even though his gallops are so short. You know, he's galloping them a mile or a mile and a quarter, a mile and a half, and you know, their heart rate is never going anywhere near, you know, an anaerobic state, but it's going up enough. But that's the one gripe that I really have is, you know, if you want to have a cumulative training effect, your works need to be close enough together that they don't just deteriorate in between, and his are generally not. So, that still is a really tough, and that's just, again, those are things that have been proven and they're documented, and there's no disputing them. It is what it is. You know, if I were to send you into the gym and have you lift weights once every month, max weight, cumulatively over the course of 3 years, you would technically not gain any strength. Maybe you would still be maturing and maybe your strength would go up a little bit, but it wouldn't be attributed to the training routine that I put you on. And that's more close to what the general horse racing, horse training populace is doing. There's no cumulative effect because the works are too far apart. It's really just more of a, I don't know, it's maybe more for their mind, or, you know, they get used to running, but they're not actually improving based on that program.
Bodie, only about a minute or so left before we have to wrap up here. You're going to have to agree to come back on and do Bodie Miller Part 2, because I feel like we're just scratching the surface right now, and looking forward to seeing you as you start training these horses and getting your name out there in the business. But you have your wife, Morgan, a daughter, two sons. What's the family think of racing?
They love it. I mean, it's obviously, like you said, it's tough because it is demanding. It takes time, but they love the horses and they love going to the track. And you know, when we were winning with carving, it's a pretty exciting, as you guys know, it's thrilling. And my kids go crazy. And that was a big part of why I did it. Is I believe it can be an incredible experience for children. It's such a good family experience being around animals. And I really look at that as a positive.
Well, Bodie, it's been a delight to visit with you and to hear your story. Can't thank you enough for taking the time. Again, we'll catch up with you here up the road. We'll do part two, but all the best moving forward, and let's stay in touch and keep it rolling.
Awesome. I appreciate you guys. Thanks.
All right, Bodie Miller here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. How cool was that?
Yeah, it was
different.
Very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
I'd like to hook him up with Dr. Fox. They would get along great.
All right, well, part two of Trainer Talk coming up next. Stay with us. Lee Delapina, our producer, he's here too. We're back with more after this on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
The Fasig Tipton November sale annually posts the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world. Over the past 10 years, 142 fillies and mares have brought prices over $1 million, and 3 world records have been broken. Last year, the Fasig Tipton November sale sold 23 seven-figure fillies and mares, more than any other mixed sale in the world, with an average sale price far greater than our nearest competitor. The world's premier breeding stock event, November 1st, 2015 at Fasig Tipton. Where will you be?
And they're off to New York, the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
And time now to showcase the Cal Density Horse of the Week, which you can find at the Keeneland September Yearling Sale. This week's horse is hip number 3448. Write it down, 3448. A colt by Spring at Last, and the first foal out of a multiple stakes winner of $237,000. That's Remit, who is a full sister to multiple graded stakes winner Tapiture and stakes winner Retap.
Consigned by Gainsway for Winchell Thoroughbred's Corinthia Farm, where he was allowed to run free, not stalled, a natural athlete to behold, and fed Cal Density Black Label daily. Veterinarian Dr. Perry Warnell at Harrison Vet Clinic in Cynthiana, Kentucky, is quoted as saying, "I have watched these horses grow up and seen the impressive growth into big, stout horses with strong bones. See for yourself the special qualities Cal Density fed horses offer, like clean radiographs, conformity, bone density, hoofs, and attitude. Visit us at barn number 2 and get the buyer's edge for this special horse. Write it down, hip number 3448, and previous week's hip numbers 1023, 1919, and 2582 at the Keeneland September yearling sale. Write them down."
The Breeders' Cup runs here.
What a memorable Breeders' Cup Classic. It's a race for the ages. Bayern, Toast of New York, California Chrome. Bayern, Toast of New York. Bayern has won it.
The Breeders' Cup, October 30th and 31st. Exclusively here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Cal Density. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information and to listen live.